The journey. Vacation. Day zero. They say it's not about the destination, it's about the journey, but sometimes they're both awful. I've taken plenty of vacations in my day that ended up being terrible wastes of time or exhausting time sucks, and the way to those places wasn't anything special either. Sure, it's nice to be off work, but in my 30s, it feels like I'm only taking off to go to weddings, using up all my personal days to watch other people say their vows, which is not the kind of holiday I'm interested in. Crowded airports, old hotels, and expensive ride shares ensue, all for 3 days of celebrating a couple that will likely be divorced in 8 months. Family trips aren't a walk in the park either. Growing up, Pellegrino family vacays were cursed, oftentimes before we even left the house. My parents, Gary and Linda, were the adults making the decisions about those outings, and I, along with my brothers, Junior and Brian, went along with what they decided. Our longest trek as a family of five was from Ohio to Florida, and it was my first experience with a beautifully disastrous holiday. Cleveland to Orlando is over 1,000 miles, and we did it twice in my childhood, both during the humidity-filled months of August. You would think we would have learned our lesson the first time, but my dad lives by the motto that if at first you don't succeed, do it again to be sure. The first Florida trip took place in the summer of 1994-ish with a new car, or rather, two new cars. When it was decided that we would be driving to the Sunshine State, we needed a bigger vehicle to house our growing bodies, and so it was time Dad hit the dealerships to turn in his compact car and get something we could all fit comfortably in with luggage. He likes to keep us all on our toes and wait until the last possible moment to do anything. So the day before we were due to leave for Florida, he finally went shopping for a sturdy set of new wheels that would get us across the country. Get a nice big van with one of those racks on the roof so we can mount our luggage in a cargo carrier, Mom instructed. I thought those turtle tops on vehicles were so glamorous when I was growing up, when in fact, the really rich people were flying on planes, not putting a Flintstones duffel bag their grandma won them at a church raffle full of homemade denim shorts on the roof of a car. You don't get good mileage with the luggage on top, Dad replied, ignoring the rest as he went on his way. Forever looking for a deal, Dad decided to go to a police auction instead of a traditional dealership like my mom and anyone rational would have done on such short notice. I've never personally been to an auction, but apparently you can get stuff at a discount when people die or businesses close down or items are confiscated by the local authorities. We all assumed he would arrive back with a reasonably priced new van from the showroom. Mom had us finish packing and bring our luggage to the garage so we could pack it up as soon as Dad got home. By pack, I mean I gathered my Garfield fanny pack, a tank that said designing woven on it that I only liked because I thought it actually said designing women on it, and my Mariah Carey cassette-filled Walkman. Just as Mom was putting the finishing touches on dinner that night and us kids were bringing our vacation luggage into the garage, Dad arrived home with the used Chevy Caprice. It wasn't just any Chevy, it was a former cop car stripped of any indication that it was primarily a police vehicle, except for the fact that it was extra big and long. Just as we were walking our suitcases outside, Dad came driving down the road in his new, big-ass car. As he pulled into the driveway, my mom looked in horror at the sheer size of this thing, while Dad had a confident smile indicating just how proud he was of his new purchase. I can't stress enough how long this car was. Too long. Like an improv show or a CVS receipt. Obviously longer than any car I had ever seen because even my 8-year-old eyes thought it was massive. I can't imagine what kind of police work was done in this thing as it looked like it moved at a snail's pace. Regardless, Dad rolled down the window as he eased into the driveway, slow enough to see the reaction on all four of our faces. Gary, what's this? Mom inquired. Our new car, Dad replied. Where's the storage top, I wondered. You said you were going to get a van, Gear. How are we all going to fit in this thing? Mom added. Even though it was grotesquely long, it didn't look like there was a lot of space for seating or storage, and Mom could see that. It's extra long, lots of trunk space for luggage. Plus, it was super cheap, Dad said. Why was it so cheap? Someone died near it or in it. Just move the luggage so I could pull this thing into the garage and we can load it up, Dad said while still in the driveway. Mom had us boys move our stuff out of the garage to make room for the new car, so I dragged my wares back inside. We lived in a modest house with what I would say was an average-sized garage. It wasn't small. It was like any of the other garages that could fit two traditional vehicles and some bikes and things. The front had cabinets that housed things like tools and old baseball gloves, plus there was a big old barrel that had loose basketballs and frisbees in it. All in all, it was a basic Midwest garage that we all assumed was normal. Dad slowly began to pull the Chevy in as my mom's eyes watched with horror. "Can I pull up anymore?" he asked as the front hood grazed against the cabinets at the front of the garage. "No, that's as far as you can go, Dad," I told him. I could see my dad's brows raised to the heavens as he inched toward the front wall, praying that he would have enough space for this thing. Unfortunately, like the time I tried to replicate an Ashton Kutcher look by wearing suspenders over a t-shirt, it didn't work. It's always something, isn't it? Either the new car doesn't fit in the garage, or you look more like the Mucinex booger than Ashton Kutcher. "Gary, the car doesn't fit," Mom said as she looked at the trunk hanging about 4 feet past the door and into the open driveway. The garage door would obviously not close with the butt of this thing sticking out so far. "What do you mean it doesn't fit?" He turned the engine off and surveyed the parked car. "You bought a car that doesn't fit in the garage, Gary," Mom shouted, both stating the obvious and embarrassing my father in front of his three impressionable young boys. Dad looked at the car and began to stew with anger. He always had a short fuse, so we knew the emotion that was coming, but we were less likely to have predicted the mix of words that would come out of his mouth. "Fucking Seremba, damn it," Dad said. I'm sure you're listening to this and thinking, what or who is Seremba? I was too. My mother, of course, immediately knew who Dad was throwing the blame to and who was the recipient of his rage. "That fucking Seremba is an idiot," he continued. "You were the one who bought a car that didn't fit in the garage, Gare. You said you were going to get a nice family van with a luggage rack," Mom reminded him, getting more and more upset herself. "There's less mileage with luggage racks, and the car would have been fine if fucking Seremba built the fucking house right," he exclaimed with eyes as wide as the trunk of the new old Chevy. Seremba was the builder of our house. No, we never once met him, but he was a prominent figure in my childhood from then on. Technically, I don't even think it was the name of a singular person, just the name of the construction business. Whenever anything would go wrong inside or around our home, Dad would say, "Fucking Seremba!" When the roof leaked because the gutters were clogged with leaves, Dad blamed fucking Seremba. When the porch swing broke after a particularly rousing thunderstorm, it was because of fucking Seremba. Seremba was the Joker to his Batman, the Burger King to his McDonald's, and the Megavolt to his Darkwing Duck. Dad hated this man with every ounce of his being, and the garage cabinets blocking the big-ass car so that it wouldn't properly close sent my dad over the edge. "Get me my box of cigarettes," he instructed me. Dad got back into the Chevy Caprice and quickly backed it all the way out of the garage while I fetched his value pack of smokes. "And grab me my hammer," he told Brian. "Keep your voice down. The neighbors will hear," Mom told him sternly through her teeth as voices escalated. "Screw the neighbors," Dad yelled from inside the vehicle as he began to unravel. He parked the car in the driveway, grabbed his box of cigs from my child hands, and surveyed the inside of the garage. "I'm going to do something that fucking Seremba should have done in the first place," he said, lighting one of his Marlboro lights, taking an aggressive drag and gripping his hammer with a strength that would make Thor jealous. "What are you going to do?" Mom asked. "A garage is for cars. I'm getting rid of these cabinets so we could fit the vehicle inside as God intended," he said as he used the claw part of the hammer to swiftly rip the cabinets from the wall. "Are you nuts? Even without the cabinets, the car still won't fit," she countered. "Sure it will, honey. It's a garage, and they're made to fit all sorts of vehicles." "The car you bought is too long. It won't fit, Gare." By this point, it didn't matter what anyone said. Dad was already halfway to ripping down the cabinets with a frustration that can only be described as Donald Duck on Adderall or a more deranged Grinch. Whatever was inside of the storage began falling out. My brothers and I were gathering up the remains and trying to find new homes for the items, while my mom threw her hands up and went inside for a glass of stress wine. This way my dad gets at times, some people call it seeing red. With him, it's like an evil spirit takes over his body. He's since tamed tremendously and is no longer a smoker, but we grew up getting to know this part of him. He became possessed, like a chain-smoking Italian version of the Hulk, but instead of trying to save the world, he was swearing at the ghost of a man and unintentionally wrecking our home. Dad spent the next hour ordering us around and making some more room in the garage for his new car. We repositioned the barrel of balls to the other side and dragged the dismembered cabinets to the curb for trash pickup. I thought it looked good and clean for such a quick renovation. I imagine that's how Joanna Gaines feels at the end of an episode of Fixer Upper. Mom, however, was horrified that the pieces of loose wood would be waiting on the curb for almost a whole week as the city had just collected our garbage. She cooled down just enough after another glass of Pinot Grigio to come back and assess the damage from the driveway, just as Dad was starting the Caprice back up to drive into the garage for a second try. "Danny, tell me how much room I have up front," Dad said. I waved him forward until the car was literally touching the wall where our storage cabinets used to be. You could see where they once were, as it was unpainted, something that would remain so for years to come and remind us of this exact moment. Dad put the car in park and asked, "Am I good back there?"
"No, you bought a car that doesn't fit in the garage, Gary," Mom informed him.
Every time she reminded him that he bought a car that didn't fit in the garage, you could see his face getting redder and redder, filled with blood and rage. If he were a cartoon, a flame would have shot from his forehead and exploded in the air like 4th of July fireworks. The most frustrating thing was that he knew Mom was right. Most people don't consider measuring the length of a vehicle before driving it home, but if you're buying an unusually long one, perhaps you should pack a ruler. Hours prior, he was on cloud nine, proud of his purchase and excited to share the good news. But now he was about ready to explode. He couldn't get mad at his wife because she sent him off to get a reasonably sized van, and we were kids, so he couldn't yell at us for this misstep. A more emotionally mature person would have blamed himself, but not my pop. He unscrewed the lid containing his anger and let out the loudest, "Fucking Saremba!" yet, as he realized there was no way to fit this thing in the garage without doing some more extensive, wall-down renovations. Mom tried to defuse the situation.
"Let's just postpone the vacation. I'll call the hotel and see if they can..."
"We're going out of town to relax, Linda,"
he replied through clenched teeth in a tone that was anything but relaxed. The words barely left his mouth as he got back into the Caprice and floored it in reverse on his way to an actual car dealership, which is where he should have gone in the first place. He couldn't return it to the police auction, but he could trade it in at a used car lot, like he had traded in the compact car we started with that morning. En route out of the driveway, he drove into one of those curbside cabinets that he ripped off the wall moments before, pummeling the loose wood into the middle of the road in front of our home and damaging the car on the way to turn it in. Rolling down the window with a freshly lit cig in his mouth, he shouted one last message to his young family.
"Get that fucking wood out of the road! I'm getting a new fucking car!"
Junior and Brian dragged the cabinet pieces back to the curb while I followed my mom inside for moral support. She poured herself another glass of stress wine at the kitchen table, emptying the bottle, licking the rim to soak up every last drop, and whispering a Hail Mary. The thought of getting into the car with three children and the evil spirit that took over Dad's body for a family road trip was almost too much for her to handle in that moment. So despite not being a regular at church, she called on God and booze. As Mom took a heavy swig of wine, she noticed the budget hotel confirmation number she had previously scribbled down on a stray Sonic the Hedgehog notepad in front of her. And she shook her head in disgust, likely thinking about all the wishes she had for the vacation week ahead. She wished she could fly instead of drive. She wished she had the money for a spacious room to share with her family instead of the cheap hotel that was booked. And her biggest wish of all was that she could go on her own vacation, putting motherhood aside for a few days to experience the type of tranquility she hadn't known since before her firstborn came along. Memories of adult trips with her girlfriends flooded her head, and she remembered the spa weekend she had with her besties in Palm Springs before she was married. Linda reminisced about the time she drank frozen daiquiris and gossiped on the beach, doing the things you're supposed to do when you're out of town and off work. The nostalgia quickly faded as she snapped back into the present.
Despite my young age, I knew in that moment that I needed to go to my room and leave her alone, aware that Mom needed another vacation from the pre-vacation and the actual vacation, just like all mothers do. A couple of hours later, after all of us were tuckered out in our rooms for the night, Dad came home with another Chevy. He was convinced Chevys run better than other brands. The extra-long car from earlier, the Chevy Caprice, was a thing of the past a mere hours after it was our expected future, and Dad replaced it with an even bigger vehicle, the Chevy Astro van. Even though this new van he got us for vacation was huge, it wasn't extraordinarily long like the other. For what was lost in length, it made up for in height. Dad was able to park the new ride in the garage without any trouble closing, and he went to bed that night at peace. Peace knowing that his wife would be pleased with the van she had originally requested. Peace knowing his kids would all fit inside of it with their luggage. And peace knowing that the garage door would safely shut. He would close his eyes next to his beautiful, almost always right wife and dream about his upcoming trip to a warm Florida beach with the family he loved. The knots of stress that developed that fateful day slowly dissipated as he drifted asleep, unaware that new stress knots would be forming very, very soon. Vacation. Day 1. With a brand new, used van ready to take us to Florida, the Pellegrino family finally loaded our luggage the next morning. While Mom was happy it was big and still fit in the garage, it didn't have the fancy rack on top for bags like she hoped for, so we had to carefully Tetris our stuff in the trunk in order for everything to fit. Dad and Brian prided themselves in utilizing the space to the best of their abilities, and somehow they got all the sausage into the casing. If you've never been inside an Astro van, you should know that there are usually three rows of seats, the driver, passenger, then two other rows in the back. For ours, the middle row of seats was removed before we even hit the road so that we could put pillows and blankets down and sleep on the way. In retrospect, this was possibly illegal and certainly not safe. With no proper seating in the back, at any given moment on the ride to Florida, there were three people shuffling around the floor of a van without a seatbelt or anything to keep them in place. Whenever we hit a speed bump, my tiny child body would fly to the air like I was on a traveling trampoline. Dad thought he was doing us a solid after the Caprice debacle by giving us extra space to sprawl out, but maybe we should have had actual seats with seatbelts. Nowadays, it seems like kids use car seats well into their teens, but we didn't adhere to those restrictions in the 90s. Not only did Dad get us the big-ass van and not make us wear seatbelts, but he also bought a tiny television set with a VCR attached. Kids today don't understand how high-tech this was. Watching movies in a moving vehicle wasn't commonplace. This was years before the headrests turned into DVD players or cell phones could play episodes of Euphoria, and we thought it was very luxe to sit on the floor of our new van and watch a movie on a 4-inch screen while my loving maniac of a father got us to Orlando. The movies we brought along were family favorites on VHS like My Cousin Vinny, Sister Act, Sister Act 2, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. My Cousin Vinny isn't exactly family-friendly, but it was my dad's fave, and Marissa Tomei made my mom laugh, so she allowed it. Ms. Tomei rightfully won the Academy Award for her performance, and the scene where she talks about the pants Vinny is wearing to shoot deer is one of the greatest comedic scenes of all time, but I digress. There are a lot of F-bombs in the movie, but no more than my dad used when talking about the man who built our house, whom he didn't even know personally. So in the words of the legendary Irish girl group Bewitched, c'est la vie. My parents didn't believe in staying anywhere overnight along the way since it was more costly, so we drove the entire distance, only stopping for food and gas, even though no one else other than my dad was equipped to drive. Mom refused because it was a big-ass Astro van without seatbelts for her children, and my brothers weren't old enough to drive yet, so that meant Dad was behind the wheel for 18-plus hours. Or so we thought. Whenever I see family road trips in movies, the wife is riding passenger, but Linda was not interested in even being up front acting as the human navigation. She wanted to lie in back and nap in between viewings of the Sister Act films. No one can resist the charms of Whoopi Goldberg and Kathy Najimy singing in Habits. Brian was the most obedient of us, so Dad convinced him to help direct him while riding passenger. Back then, there were no Google Maps or MapQuest or TomTom, so Brian had a giant paper map that was bigger than he was. If you asked me to use that thing, even now, I would lead you to the Emerald City, not Florida. When I see a map, all my critical thinking skills go out the window, and I feel like I'm looking at one of those magic eye layouts you used to see in the Sunday newspaper. My brain simply cannot compute a map of any kind. Dad also had a fancy radar detector that was supposed to beep every time we were near the police so he could slow down and drive the speed limit, but that soon went to shit. About an hour into the drive, it wouldn't stop beeping, so Dad threw it out the window and Brian had to act as a Foley artist, making noises if he saw a speed gun or anything that resembled the car that didn't fit in our garage the night before. During the middle of the night driving, the TV went off and Mom, Junior, and I went to sleep, while Dad and Brian kept us on schedule. I know I said my dad was piloting for 18-plus hours, but it's time I live my truth. I have a vivid memory of that specific road trip that comes to me at random like a That's So Raven vision. Sometimes I'll see this in my sleep, and other times it will come to me when I'm in line at the grocery or working out at the gym. It was the wee hours, and everyone in back was snoozing. The car swerved, and my tiny body slid across the floor of the van, abruptly waking me up. My eyes opened, and I wondered if we had arrived in Florida. I soon realized I was still in the van, and we were on a quiet road, most likely somewhere outside of Georgia. I heard a familiar snoring, but Mom and Junior were both quiet sleepers, so I knew it wasn't them. This was the loud snore of a grown man. I glanced at the dashboard to look at the time. I rubbed my eyes to see more clearly, but I still couldn't make out the digits on the clock, so I grabbed my glasses and put them on to see that it was just after 3 a.m. The loud snores came from up front, so with my corrected vision, I looked at the culprit in the passenger seat. It was Dad. So by now, you're probably wondering who was driving. I was too. Mom was passed out, and the rest of us were 14 and under. Before I could do the math, I heard my 12-year-old brother. "Go to sleep, Danny." Brian was behind the wheel, with Mom and Dad off in dreamland. "Why are you driving?" I asked him in a whisper. It was a simple, innocuous question, but Brian acted like I asked him something absurd. I might as well have said, "Why are you dressed like Ursula the Sea Witch?" or "Are you the Zodiac Killer?" I thought my question was valid and straightforward, but Brian was wildly offended and simply wanted to continue his journey of being in charge of our collective journey. "Dad was teaching me how to drive. Now shut up and go back to bed." "But Dad's asleep," I replied. "You should be too," Brian instructed. "But..." My line of questioning was distracting him from the task at hand, and he briefly found himself driving on the wrong side of the road. He swerved to get us back on track, and fortunately, or unfortunately, the sudden movement didn't wake up any of the others, although Dad shifted a bit in the passenger. "Go back to sleep. You're annoying me," he exclaimed. Rather than argue, I followed his instructions and curled back up with my blanket. Years before Carrie Underwood rose to fame courtesy of American Idol, I lay back down and I too called for Jesus to take the wheel as I closed my eyes on a midnight Astrovan through Georgia. I'm not sure why I was so comfortable sleeping when my life was in the hands of a tween who hadn't even hit puberty, but I drifted off to bed and my eyes wouldn't reopen until the next morning. The sun rose and I too began to awaken. As I put my glasses on again, I saw that Dad was back in the driver's seat as if nothing had happened. Was I dreaming? How long was my 12-year-old brother leading us to Florida? I may never know. Mom couldn't believe how chipper Dad was the next day, and they were laughing and making cute jokes with each other all morning as we entered the Florida state limits. "Normally you're cranky if you don't get enough sleep," I overheard Mom say to Dad.
"Vacation is all about relaxing," he said calmly as if he'd unlocked the secret to a successful trip.
"It must have been a bumpy road because I felt like I rocked to sleep," she said. What she didn't know is that the rockiness was due to her middle child being barely able to see the road and reach the pedal at the same time without driving us into a ditch. And Dad was only happy because he'd gotten a few solid hours of Z's. Brian, on the other hand, was grumpier than usual. Instead of sleeping like the rest of us, he drove from Savannah to Jacksonville without any conscious company. And when Dad finally did come to, Brian was forced to direct him again and keep an eye out for the popo. When we finally arrived at our destination, Mom and Dad instructed us to stay in the car while they checked us in at the hotel office. The vacation property was set up differently than a traditional resort.
There was an office in one location, and down the road in a separate building were the rooms that the guests stayed in. Us kids watched as they got the keys from the rental office, anxiously awaiting the moment we could get out of the godforsaken van we had spent so many hours in. Despite having extra legroom without the middle row of seats, it wasn't like we were in a spacious camper. It was still four males and one adult female in a van for the length of time it would take us to watch the entire The Lord of the Rings extended edition saga, plus The Irishman and a Judd Apatow feature. The parents came back to the vehicle from the check-in office holding our room key and a flower pot with a gator and flamingo holding hands on it, which Mom gripped proudly. The check-in office had a little gift shop, and she saw a pot she liked quite a bit, so she splurged and bought it, declaring the pot her first souvenir. She had a wide smile on her face, and while it might not have seemed like much, purchasing it was her way of starting the trip off with the splurge. The night prior was so chaotic and the drive so long, she wanted to treat herself now that she assumed the fun part of the vacation was about to start. The rooms were a few blocks away from the check-in center, so we had to drive just a little bit more. Once we arrived in our designated parking spot, Dad opened the back of the van and started to unpack the luggage immediately, even before checking out our new digs. The baggage had fit perfectly in the van, so emptying became a strategic game to ensure things didn't fall out willy-nilly. All the bags came out one by one, and we sat them outside the car so it would be easy for all of us to take everything inside, like a family-style assembly line. Just as we got the last of the gear out of the trunk, we heard a scream. Mom noticed the window of our hotel room was shattered, looking like someone had broken in, so we wouldn't be staying there after all. That meant the belongings my dad just carefully unloaded would now have to return to the trunk. "Damn it," Dad said, this time unable to blame the events on Saremba. Packing the van the first time not only took him about an hour, but it also took a lot of concentration. He was lacking the patience and demeanor to do it for a second time after such a long road trip. He was trying his best to remain calm, but his patience wouldn't last long. The bigger bags went in, and he tried to position everything else the way it was before the broken hotel window reveal. He'd ask us boys to hand him others to speed up the process, but with only half the goods in and the trunk seemingly already full, there was no way he was packing it as efficiently as he did the first time. "Should have gotten the cargo carrier," Mom said under her breath, but purposely loud enough for everyone to hear. Dad pulled everything out of the trunk again and started over, his temper now flaring as he tried to repack the luggage of five people. Ordinarily, he would have reached for a smoke, but Mom wouldn't let him pack his cigarettes on the trip, encouraging him to quit over the relaxing vacation. Oops. "Get in the van, I'll load it myself," he told us. We all knew that meant everyone except Brian should go back into the vehicle. Junior and I got out of a lot of manual labor throughout the years because we weren't quite as obedient. He and I are both more stubborn than Brian is, so our middle brother got stuck being Dad's right-hand man, even when he was running on zero sleep. My mom set down her new flower pot alongside the luggage outside the van and then settled in while Dad and Brian took care of it. I continued to watch them through the window as they tried to fit everything, this time seemingly finding more success than the last effort, and pretty soon everything was loaded in other than my mom's new souvenir flower pot. I watched as Brian handed it to Dad to pack in, but without missing a beat, Dad tossed it into a nearby trash can, shattering it to pieces before he slammed the trunk closed and got back in the driver's seat. "I threw away your ceramic tub," he announced glibly as he put the keys into the ignition, not thinking it was of any real importance. "My what?" Mom asked. "The tub." "What tub?" "Your ceramic tub." "A bathtub?" "Your plant tub." "What's a plant tub?" Your fucking tub, Dad said, surely wishing he had a Marlboro to calm his nerves. When Dad got this upset, he didn't make any sense. Part of me thinks my mom liked to rile him up by acting clueless just to get under his skin. It always worked, and I find myself using this tactic to piss off people in my own adult life. It's one of the most fun ways to annoy people. "I don't know what you're talking about."
"Your ceramic plant tub," he yelled.
"My flower pot?" she asked.
"Yes, I threw it away."
"Why are you calling it a ceramic tub, Gare?"
"That's what it is."
"It's a flower pot."
"Same thing."
"Turn back around. I want to go get it."
"It's broken. I threw it in the trash can."
Gary, I just bought it.
We don't have room for it.
You should have gotten a van with a cargo carrier, like I said, Mom told him. Mom's always right, I added.
Do you want to go back home? Because I'll drive us right back to Ohio,
Dad replied. Brian's eyes went wide as soon as this threat left my father's mouth. He worried that he'd have to take the wheel, and he wasn't ready for that kind of responsibility quite so quickly after his last late-night drive.
If you would have gotten the cargo carrier, we could have put our souvenirs in the trunk, Mom said.
We don't need any souvenirs. We have enough shit at home, Dad countered.
It was cute.
Flamingos and gators aren't friends, Lynn.
I'll buy my souvenirs if I want to buy my souvenirs. You're buying cars left and right.
This is a van, not a car.
You bought that other car. You got this van and that other one that...
The words were coming out of her mouth, and even she knew that what she was about to say was going to push him over the edge, but she didn't care. She wanted this man to know that she was right and he was wrong. If he had put his ego aside and listened to her in the first place, then maybe we all wouldn't be in this mess.
Don't say it, Dad pleaded.
You bought that other car. That didn't fit in the garage.
Silence. He hung his head in shame as the air went out of Dad's metaphorical tires and he finally had to accept defeat. No one else said a word as we pulled back into the hotel check-in office parking lot, ready to exchange the keys and get a new room. Dad went in while Mom waited in the van with us, arms crossed and no stress wine for her to grab hold of. After a few minutes, he exited the office with a pamphlet and a brand new flower pot, only this pot was bigger and shinier than the one that was shattered near our previously booked room, albeit without the animals on it. He entered the van and handed it to Mom in the back seat without saying a word, and she didn't say anything either, just shooting him a look. I learned in that moment that two people in a marriage can say so much without saying anything at all. Mom looked out the window as she held her new pot, and we exited the lot in the Astrovan, a van that had already created a lifetime of memories. I assumed Dad booked us a new room at the same hotel, but I was wrong. Instead, we hit the open road. Dad glanced at his pamphlet while the rest of us sat exhausted at what was the start of our family trip, quietly looking out the windows and wondering how we would all survive the next few days with each other. A few minutes later, we pulled into a resort that looked way chicer than that other place we were planning to stay. It says they have HBO in the rooms, I shouted as I saw the sign outside, excited to spend my nights watching Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead like everyone else who had premium cable did in the 90s.
Looks like we'll have HBO this week, Dad assured.
When he went into the original hotel office, he canceled our reservation and made a new one. He splurged for a nicer hotel without running it by any of us. It probably cost more than he wanted, and who knows if he was fully refunded for the last place, but it was his way of apologizing. The new hotel had a pool, a bar, and a much bigger souvenir shop in the lobby, filled with all sorts of items no one needs but will buy anyway because that's what you do on vacations. You buy expensive souvenirs that remind you that you're supposed to treat yourself. It was the kind of hotel Mom had wished she was staying at 24 hours earlier when she was making her wishes. She got out of the van with a confident smile on her face and a new flamingo-less flower pot in her hands. It wasn't the spa getaway she daydreamed about being on with her friends, and it certainly wasn't a relaxing few days, but at least she got a room upgrade and only had a few days left. Mom looked at the family she loved more than anything, the kids who were already exhausted and the husband she so carefully chose to spend the rest of her life with, and she realized that a family vacation isn't about having fun or recharging your batteries. It's about finding the little victories on the way to the finish line. It's about getting through the journey alongside the ones you love. Sadness Unfelt. There's an E.E. Cummings poem titled I Carry Your Heart that I first heard in the 2005 Cameron Diaz, Toni Collette, underrated movie In Her Shoes. It's a beautiful piece that I interpret differently every time I hear or read it, like the best art always asks you to do. In many ways, it encapsulates what this entire existence and ride is all about. We go through life carrying the hearts of those who mean the most to us, becoming a collection of the best, and sometimes worst, of those people.
In putting this audiobook together, I thought not just about the stories I wanted to share, but also about what I wanted to say, which are two very different things. First and foremost, I hope you find a good laugh somewhere in this audiobook, but I also hope you take some things beyond the listen by carrying a little piece of me with you. My grandmother and I were very close when she was alive. She was an angel, and I still find myself thinking of her daily. Grandma P would look after me in the afternoons when my mom was working. We would watch The Rosie O'Donnell Show or reruns of The Golden Girls together before driving to pick up my grandfather from work. As I got older, we still managed to find time to spend with each other, but it dwindled. She didn't have a lot of money, but she always made an effort to make those outings special, collecting coupons in an envelope and letting me choose which one we would use for our lunch dates. Even throughout college, I would come home for the holidays and we would browse the envelope for a cheap meal that was just an excuse to spend time together. We were family, but we were also buddies. My ambition took me to Chicago after college and later California. Grandma started to get sick when I moved to the West Coast. We would talk on the phone, and each time her voice would be weaker and weaker as she courageously battled cancer. "Do you want me to try to come home?" I'd ask. "No, I'm fine. You have to stay there and become a big star," she'd say quietly into the phone as someone held it close to her mouth. Our calls got shorter and shorter as time went on, often interrupted by another family member or nurse who would tell me she was too tired to talk. I'd feel a tinge of guilt about not being there that I was able to quickly talk myself out of, thinking I was doing what was best for me by building a new life. Eventually, the call that I was dreading came. It was my dad telling me that she passed. My heart broke as I searched online for budget flights back to Ohio. "Keep it together," I would tell myself to try to stop the tears in front of my then roommate. I've always been comfortable crying, but not so much when it was in front of other people. A few days prior to her passing, I met a guy, we'll call him Josh, at the bookstore that I used to frequent, and he asked me on a date. When we met, he was working on what I thought was poetry, but was actually a class from a scammy online college where the diploma is just an email that says, "You're done." He wore casually sexy glasses and drank a tall iced coffee, muscles bursting out of his short-sleeve button-down shirt. Josh was sexy smart in a Clark Kent kind of way, looked very rich, and I was convinced he was the man I was going to marry. Rather than cancel on him, I thought I'd fly out a night later, which would also save me some money and allow me to get to know the man that I was convinced would father my children. Let's take a little detour. It makes me sad that bookstores are becoming more and more obsolete. I spent years working at a Borders book retailer in Solon, Ohio, and before that I used to spend afternoons in the shop reading Men's Health, staring at the shirtless men within the pages, and eventually discovering that the establishment also carried adult mags. Not only that, but they had an alternative interests section filled with all the gay books you could imagine, and also vegan cookbooks because being vegan in the Midwest was considered an alternative lifestyle back then. I would grab hold of the more traditional publications like USA Today, Entertainment Weekly, and People before snagging a Playgirl and whatever alternative lifestyle books I could find. I'd then hide all the gayest stuff underneath my copy of USA Today before retreating to the corner of the coffee shop to look at the topless men and read about gay culture. It felt like a new world was opening up to me, like the first time walking into a Hot Topic after listening to Evanescence. Stories of worldly homosexuals filled the pages I read, and I began to dream of a life living in a big city surrounded by good-looking men in high-end clothes, with Starbucks coffee and diverse friends. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan's You've Got Mail also inspired these dreams. These books were my only view of the outside world at the time, an insight into the possibility of being confident, successful, and gay. I'm forever grateful for bookstores for showing me that a world such as that existed. "Am I being insensitive?" I asked my roommate. "No, it will be good to get your mind off things. Go out with the guy and have fun," she encouraged. I decided to keep our date and crossed my fingers that the emotions of my grandmother's passing wouldn't spill out with him. I was wrong. Josh didn't tell me what the plans were, and since he asked me out, I assumed he would take care of all that. I wanted to play it cool, so I didn't ask many questions, simply put on my hottest outfit, which was hand-me-down True Religion jeans that were a size too small, and the only sweater I owned that cost more than $35, and waited for him to pick me up. He arrived 23 minutes late in his brand new BMW, freshly cleaned and no longer wearing his sexy glasses, yet somehow looking even sexier without. "Where are we headed?" I asked, pretending I hadn't been waiting outside my apartment building for 22 minutes while looking at old pictures of my grandma on my phone. "I thought we'd do dinner and maybe get some ice cream for dessert," he replied. My grief now seemed like a distant memory with the sight of Josh and his beautifully big thighs and a new car. They say the best way to get over someone is to get under someone new, so I was ready to get under Josh and forget about my Nana. Maybe that's not exactly what the phrase was about, but carpe diem. Anyway, seeing him in person reminded me that everything about him exuded wealth, so my only concern was that I would be underdressed for dinner. I started to worry he was out of my league. Josh was one of those insane drivers who will make you fear for your life, so once we drove out of my building's parking lot, I was silently praying that I wouldn't be joining my grandma anytime soon in the afterlife. I'm terrible behind the wheel, but there's a big difference between terrible and maniacal. He drove at least 20 miles per hour over the speed limit the entire way, ran stop signs, red lights, and overall just made me feel like I was in the passenger seat of Luigi's car on Rainbow Road. Still, part of me found it extremely hot that he was so reckless. I was young and naive. While the other part of me was concerned we wouldn't make it to dinner because we would get pulled over or someone would hit us with a red turtle shell. We eventually did arrive at the parking lot of a strip mall. "Are we picking up something before dinner?" I asked, assuming maybe he had to run into the drugstore. "No, we're here," he said. I looked around and saw no establishments that looked like where I imagined we would go on our first dinner date. There was a Walgreens, a karate dojo, and a fast food restaurant that served Americanized Mexican food. Certainly he wasn't taking me to a chain restaurant where you seat yourself, right? I thought maybe he would escort me into the karate dojo, where a picnic would be awaiting us. Instead, we walked into the place that had a drive-thru attached. "Let me remind you all that I'm not someone who expects a lot, and I can appreciate dining modestly. I ride hard for Arby's, but this man had a BMW and, I'd find out later, a platinum Amex, so shouldn't we have been eating steak and diamonds instead of 79-cent tacos?" We waited in line to order, and my whole life flashed before my eyes. I had already felt so bad about not being with my grandma before she passed, and now I was sacrificing being with my family in a time of mourning to eat at a place that gave off-brand Hot Wheels toys with the kids' meals. Just as I considered running for the door and catching a cab home, I noticed that his shirt lifted a bit near his belt buckle, and he had one of those protruding veins right where the top of his pubic hair peeked out. It was enough to encourage me to ignore the red flags and enjoy a fountain Diet Coke. "Can I take your order?" the cashier asked as we reached the front of the line. "You go ahead," I said to Josh. "No, no, you go. I'm still looking," he insisted. I ordered a salad, a small drink, and then turned my head to look back toward Josh. "Go ahead and check out. I'll order separately," he said. This was it, a step too far. Now I was livid. When I turned my head toward him, I was expecting him to swoop in, order his own meal, and then whip out that platinum card to pay for both of us. Instead, I had to pay for my own meal. Without getting too far into gay dating etiquette, let me just say that he was the one who asked me out, so therefore I expected him to pay. I mean, that's universal manners. I knew he had the money, but even if he didn't, I would have been more than happy to do a non-dinner date or spend the night at one of our apartments where I would recommend renting a Marvel movie on demand and then accidentally rent Something's Gotta Give instead. And if I was the one who asked him out, I would have been sure to take him somewhere I could afford to pay for both of us. None of his plans sat right with me. Maybe Countess Luann is right. Elegance is learned, my friends. And yet still, I pressed on, waiting for the employee to set my $3.99 salad on top of the plastic lunch tray that they served their meals on so I could find us a table that didn't wobble. My order was up first, so I grabbed the only open seating I could find, which was right next to the pour-your-own-salsa bar. Josh eventually joined me with his burrito, and in between pleasantries, other patrons would come and fill up their plastic cups of six different kinds of salsa that all looked like they hadn't been refreshed since the lunch shift. After just a few bites of his meal, Josh excused himself to the restroom. As I sat alone, I heard Madonna's La Isla Bonita playing softly on the loudspeaker. The second verse hit, I looked around at the families gathered for an affordable meal, and the sadness of the Pellegrino Grand Matriarch passing washed over me.
Tears flooded out into my free side of tortilla chips as I grabbed as many paper napkins as I could to stop the outward sorrow, once again reminding myself to pull it together before someone saw me sobbing to a Madonna ballad. Fast food joints aren't known for their soft linens, so the more I dabbed, the redder my eyes got. I was able to stop the tears and compose myself moments before Josh returned and Madge finished her song. "Everything okay?" he asked, noticing that my eyes were now devil red from the harsh recycled materials of the cheapest napkins ever made. "Allergies," I lied, worried he might feel uncomfortable if he knew what I was actually feeling. "Your eyes look like shit," he added. "It must be pollen or something," I said, brushing off his rude comment as if it were nothing, even though it emphasized my pain. We spent the rest of the meal in silence, and we opted not to get dessert. By all accounts, this man was an asshole, but I still worried about him being inconvenienced by my sadness. As his Beamer pulled back into my apartment building's parking lot to drop me off, he put it in park and leaned in for a kiss. "That's okay," I said as I gently pushed his lips away. Burrito breath aside, I just wasn't feeling this man anymore. My standards may have been basement level, but they did exist. Josh drove off, and I went into my apartment to start packing for my real home, wishing I could teleport to Ohio instead of taking a 4.5-hour plane ride. The travel time did end up coming in handy as I wrote a tribute to my grandma that would ultimately become her eulogy. After the funeral services, I got a text from Josh asking to see me again. I was so emotionally raw that I finally allowed myself to be honest with my feelings, and I texted him a gif of Teresa Giudice from The Real Housewives of New Jersey angrily flipping a table, then I went right back to stuffing all that emotion inside. We're often told that it's okay to grieve when someone you love dies, but not for too long. A couple days seems to be socially acceptable, but any more than that and people worry, so we bite our tongues and wait for it to come out at a later date, which is exactly what happened on that date. Years went by, and the guilt and sadness about not being with my grandma toward the end of her life stayed within me, flaring up at random when I'd see episodes of The Golden Girls or when I'd hear Danny Boy, a song she used to sing to me as a young kid. Every year on my birthday, she would buy me a lottery ticket, the numbers strategically chosen by her, each with a specific meaning. I couldn't even buy a scratch-off without thinking of her, the memory of her passing, and the guilt I felt. Each time I felt this sorrow again, I would push the despair down and try to remember the good times, reminding myself to keep it together, never allowing the tears to surface, even just a few like when I was on that wretched date, and especially not when anyone else was near me. After all, I wouldn't want to make anyone around me feel awkward. In 2020, I had Teresa Caputo, also known as the Long Island Medium, a woman who connects with spirits, on my podcast. I prepped for the interview by researching her work and seeing a couple readings she did on YouTube. I wrote questions down about when she started her business and what she was like as a child, never expecting my own past or deceased relatives to come up in conversation for my podcast. When it came time to sit down with her over Zoom, I was skeptical of her talents while also being excited to chat. As the talk went on, she began to do a reading on me, culminating in what she described as my grandmother being present with us virtually. Simply mentioning my grandma's death caused tears to run down my face like a faucet. My inner voice was telling me to pretend I was okay like I always did, but I had no control this time. I wanted to stop the conversation, gather my thoughts, and pivot back to the medium's life and career so she didn't feel weird, but instead I was frozen in my sadness. Just like that, those emotions I had stuffed down came bubbling up to the surface, and when I finished crying, I felt a catharsis unlike anything I'd experienced before. I understand that everyone feels differently regarding Teresa Caputo and her work, but I am forever grateful for that moment when I realized that some of my deepest, darkest pain was there, dormant like the cancer my grandmother was ultimately unable to fight off. It clicked. I'll always regret not flying home to be with her, but at least now I can go forward knowing that it's okay to face that regret head on, regardless of when I feel it. We can't change the past, but we can change how we act in the future. Writing this book has been its own catharsis, digging up feelings I had forgotten about and emotions I never properly dealt with. I'm sure I'll continue to stuff everything inside and ignore it from time to time, but I know now that they will eventually come bubbling up, and that's okay. I'm no longer a stranger to the heavy pour of tears moving south on my cheeks.
I often joke about how my favorite place to cry is in the shower because there's something so freeing about the water mixing with tears in a steady rainfall, unsure which is which. When the tears came that night of my fast food date, I tried to stop them. A decade later, when the crying started over a Zoom interview, I again tried to stop them because I was conditioned to hold my emotions in. Turns out the Trolls soundtrack was right. You can't stop the feeling. I know now that this is an issue bigger than the memory of my grandma. It's about all the sorrow we conceal for the convenience of other people. What if we allowed ourselves to feel whatever came our way, whenever it came our way, while prioritizing ourselves over the potential awkwardness that the humans around us might face if we do? Would we be less apt to bury it inside our bodies? And the unfinished grief that is already 6 feet under, how can we dig it up to process it properly? Because I know that only when we release those feelings will we have room inside ourselves for all the other stuff, the good stuff. The deepest secret about me that no one knows is that I not only carry the hearts of my loved ones like E.E. Cummings so eloquently wrote all those years ago, but I also too often carry the burden of my sadness unfelt. Unprocessed grief is the worst sort, and saying this is a reminder to give myself the permission to feel everything when I feel it and free my body from the weight of my disregarded emotions. I hope you'll join me. Cootie Catcher. Maybe there won't be marriage, maybe there won't be sex, but by God, there'll be dancing. My best friend's wedding, 1997. Coming out is, I hope, much easier now than it was even just 10 or 15 years ago when I did it. Just as it was easier for me than the older generations of gay men. I consider my official out-of-the-closet moment to be Thanksgiving weekend 2009. I was living in Chicago and dating men, specifically a cute cowboy I started throwing around I love yous with. So when I went back to Ohio for turkey and family time, I sat everyone down for a dramatic monologue on the Monday after the big dinner to let them know. Dad was easygoing about it, Mom struggled a bit more to accept it, but everyone came around and supported me over time. The cowboy and I didn't work out, but I'll be forever grateful that he gave me the push I needed to be honest with my family. I'll never forget that it was raining that November day, and I had to pick up something from a nearby Walmart. When I arrived and got out of my parents' car sans umbrella, I stuck my arms out and had a moment with the rain, washing away the pain of living inauthentically for so long. My shoulders felt lighter than they had in years, and I smiled knowing I was finally in my truth. I felt like Tim Robbins on the Shawshank Redemption poster, but in reality, I probably looked like Danny DeVito as the penguin floating in water at the end of Batman Returns. Regardless, it was a cathartic moment. Most gay men I know have multiple coming out moments. There's the family convo, the time you tell your closest friends, and of course, the moment you sneak your first same-sex kiss. My first kiss with a man was in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, when I was 18 on a spring break trip with my friends. Technically, he was the first person I ever voluntarily came out to, via my tongue in his mouth, but after that, I went back in the closet and tried to date women until I was ready to admit to myself and my loved ones that I'm attracted to men. All these coming outs were emotional for me, but there's one moment with a friend that forever sticks out as the most impactful. It's not a time I chose to disclose my sexuality. Unfortunately, it was a time I was abruptly outed. My friend Anna invited me over to her house to hang in middle school. We were buddies, and I tended to gravitate toward friendships with girls in school over the boys. After my traumatic and humiliating streaking sleepover, I wasn't interested in hanging with guys on a platonic level. Plus, the girls did all the fun stuff. I wanted to play MASH or The Flame Game and talk about movies like The Parent Trap and Practical Magic. 12 is hard enough, but it's made easier when you could be around people who have similar interests. Anna invited me over into her bedroom, where we decided to make one of those cootie catchers. If you're not familiar, those are the little paper fortune tellers that you fold up a bunch of different ways. Parts are labeled with colors and others with numbers, and the inside has predictions or messages written on them. Anna made one that she would use on me, and I made one to use on her, and we were convinced they would forecast our future. I wrote silly predictions about money and boys in our class. When we were all done crafting, I put my index fingers and thumbs in mine and asked Anna to pick a color out of the four listed on the top of my cootie catcher. Red, she said. R-E-D, red, I repeated, moving my fingers as I called out each letter so that the paper fortune teller showed numbers. Pick a number, I instructed. 2. 1, 2, I counted, again rhythmically moving my folded paper. Now pick another number, I said, knowing that her choice now would be the fortune that she received. 1, she told me. I unfolded the flap that was labeled 1 and read, "You will find lots of money in the near future." "Oh my God, I'm going to be a rich bitch," Anna exclaimed. "Now I want to do it," I said to Anna, ready for her to grab the cootie catcher she just made. Just as she put her fingers in it, there was a knock at her bedroom door. It was her dad. "Hi, Danny," Mr. Burles said. "Hi, Mr. Burles." "Anna, I'm sorry, but no boys in the bedroom," he told his daughter. "But..." Before Anna could finish her sentence, Mr. Burles looked me up and down, noticing the pink and purple crayons I used on my origami. He saw the limp of my wrist and asked, "You made that yourself, Danny?" "Yeah, it's a cootie catcher," I told him. "Maybe it's okay for you two to hang out in here. Have fun," he said as he began walking out the door, assuming I wouldn't be making a pass at his daughter. "Wait, Mr. Burles, do you know if the Cavs won their game tonight?" I asked before he walked out the door. He paused and then slowly turned his head in my direction.
"You like basketball, Danny?"
"I do love to watch basketball." Mr. Burles turned back around and said, "You know what? I think I'll hang in here for a few more minutes." Anna's dad pulled up the only seat at his disposal, one of those inflatable chairs that were all the rage in the late 90s and early 2000s. If you had anything sharp on you, you were fucked, but they looked cute and they were see-through. Not sure why we need to see through our furniture, but I digress. "Oh my God, we should do my dad's fortune," Anna said.
"How does that work?" he asked.
"You'll do great, Mr. Burles. First, pick a color," I instructed as I put my hands back into my cootie catcher.
"Blue."
"B-L-U-E," I repeated. "Now pick a number."
6.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. "Now pick another number," I said.
4, he replied.
"Oh my God," I said as I lifted the flap to reveal Mr. Burles' fortune.
"What does it say?" he asked.
"It says be careful who you trust because someone's going to trick you tonight," I replied. His eyes furrowed as anger washed over him. He felt bamboozled.
"Someone is trying to trick me? Okay, Danny, you need to leave. No boys in Anna's room," Mr. Burles said sternly as he got back up and headed for the door.
Anna looked so disappointed, and I was too. I knew her dad was just being protective, but I wasn't a threat like the other boys who might have spent time at their house trying to make out with his daughter. I just wanted to hang out. "Fine, I'll pack up my stuff and get out of here," I said. "Let Danny stay. We're having fun," Anna shouted back at her father, hoping to convince him to let me stay.
"No boys in your room. You two can go play in the basement or the living room," he said.
"But Dad, you let cousin Mark play in my room."
"He's your cousin and he's..." "No other boys in your room, Anna."
"But Danny is just like cousin Mark," she replied. At this point, I had no clue what exactly they were referring to regarding this alleged cousin Mark, but I did sense something off about the coded language these two were speaking right in front of me, and it felt very uncomfortable. What did Anna mean when she said her cousin Mark was just like me? Was cousin Mark Italian? Was he tall like I was?
"He's just like cousin Mark?" Mr. Burles asked his daughter.
Anna explained, "Yeah, I think so. Danny likes basketball, but he also likes MASH, and he plays with my Polly Pockets." "I like all sorts of stuff," I told them, finally speaking up for myself, feeling like I suddenly needed to defend myself for enjoying the simple pleasures of a Polly Pocket. Mr. Burles looked so confused and not quite ready to give up on his quest to figure me out.
"How about I hang out with you both for just a few more minutes? I can try to read Danny's fortune," he said as he sat back down on the balloon that was Anna's bedroom furniture.
Anna handed him the origami she made, and he placed his index finger and thumb inside and looked me dead in the eyes.
"Pick a color," he said with the kind of intensity usually reserved for interrogations.
"Green," I said.
"G-R-E-E-N,
Mr. Burles said, suddenly an expert in cootie catching.
"Pick a number."
3, I replied.
1, 2, 3. Now pick another number.
1, I said.
Mr. Burles lifted up the flap of the paper fortune teller that Anna made and read it aloud to me.
You will get to third base tonight.
Oh my God, I said to myself, uncomfortable with the implication I was somehow going to go to third base with his daughter. When Anna crafted that prediction, she wasn't referring to me and her. It was just a silly thing she wrote on the flap.
Okay, that's it. Danny, time to go, now!
Mr. Burles yelled in my direction. I knew nothing I would say or do would matter in that moment because the origami said I was going to get to third base, and he took that as fact. I stood up and gathered my art supplies, stuffed them into my backpack, and got ready to head out the door as instructed. Danny's gay! Anna yelled. Gay! She repeated, sounding like Brittany Murphy in Drop Dead Gorgeous. Like a bullet straight into my heart. It would be a whole decade until I would actually accept the terms and conditions of being homosexual myself, so I certainly wasn't prepared to be outed just so I could play MASH in my classmate's bedroom. I ran out of the room as fast as I could and hopped on my bike to ride home, horrified, crying the entire way, not because I was kicked out of my friend's house, but because maybe Anna was right. Facing the truth can be much harder than ignoring it. From then on, every single time I'd have feelings for another guy, I would do everything I could to stop them, remembering the tears that fell to the dirt road on my bike ride home from Anna's house. Even during my senior spring break, when I snuck off to that gay bar and kissed my Myrtle Beach man, I hustled back to my hotel room and cried alone in the bathroom, those same middle school feelings flooding back to me. I worried that being gay meant I would never fall in love or have kids. I worried that everyone who did love me would stop if they knew I had been lying to them about it, even though I didn't exactly know who I was myself. Those years when you're figuring it all out can be mental torture, but if you can get through them, you can have your moment in the rain when all that self-loathing and confusion washes away and you realize that life doesn't stop when you come out. In fact, life begins because you're finally living it authentically. Once everyone knew I was gay, I stopped caring about what I liked or didn't like and how it was perceived by others. If I want to memorize the spoken word intro to Monica and Brandy's The Boy Is Mine song, I will. If I want to go to a solo matinee of the Little Women remake, I'll go. There are things that society still considers masculine or for boys, things like sports or cars. And then there are things like dresses and dolls that are still considered only appropriate for women. These labels can be so harmful, and it's time we rid ourselves of the stereotypes. Like what you like, and know that if it isn't harming others, it's okay. I know men who love to play with makeup, women who like football, and non-binary people who like both. Some of those people are straight, some are gay, others bisexual, and many who identify as something else. A family friend recently told me that his 7-year-old son wanted a Barbie, and he was afraid to buy it for him. He said if his son never has the doll, he won't know what he's missing. But it's the dad who is the one who's going to be missing something. He'll be missing who his son really is, and he'll be missing the tears that will be happening on those bike rides home. Let's take a little detour. The Flame Game. Now, MASH is a classic, and I highly recommend that you partner up with a buddy to play. But in the meantime, Flame is a game that can be played with a friend or solo. So let's all take a moment to have some fun, shall we? For this example, we'll determine what your relationship with Idris Elba should be. You can substitute Idris Elba with any of your favorite leading men. I chose Idris because I just watched the movie Molly's Game, where he's looking flawless in a suit, and I honestly can't stop thinking about it. If you're someone who is not into Idris Elba, which seems impossible, but whatevs, substitute his name with someone to your liking physically. It's a fantasy, so Google instructions, have some fun, and get creative. No judgment here. Butts and Kelly. I know I said I would change the names in this book, but it's imperative that in this next story, I maintain the truth that is Butts and Kelly. Butts and Kelly are two small mixed-breed dogs that belong to a piano teacher I had, Miss Donna. My parents were more of a sports family, rarely pushing me and my brothers into the creative arts, but we did have family friends who had a daughter my age and would often sign me up for things like drawing class or piano lessons. I can't sing, but around middle school I saw Divas Live 1998 and figured if I can't sing like those queens did during the Natural Woman finale, at least I could play an instrument near the women who could. So Mom signed me up for weekly piano lessons at Miss Donna's house, a quirky woman in her late 60s who lived alone with Butts, Kelly, and a wide array of horse photos adorning her walls, which she would talk to as if they were in the room. "My horsey," she'd say in an adult baby voice that would send chills down anyone's spine, pointing to a framed image above the piano. The equestrian decor was all different. Some were oil paintings, others looked like they were drawn in the style of Bob's Burgers. The only through line was that there were horses featured in every hung piece. You know how some people have kitchens filled with word art from Home Goods? It was like that, only instead of live, laugh, love signs, there was horse art everywhere. Let's take a little detour. Home Goods is my favorite place on earth. I'm never more at peace than when I'm walking the aisles, browsing the cooking oils, shuffling through the racks of towels, or rummaging the holiday merch section for seasonal gnomes. It's pure bliss, but it's imperative that you curate your shopping trip. We've all made mistakes there before, getting a little too excited after grabbing the cart, throwing everything that sparks joy inside of it. You ladies know what I'm talking about. Marie Kondo wants us to get rid of shit, but I can only assume that's because she's never been inside of a Home Goods. Whenever I'm there, like Ashley Tisdale in High School Musical 3, I want it all. Regardless, you must look at your cart before you head to the checkout and remove some stuff. Count your word art and remove at least one item. There's a famous saying about removing an accessory before you leave the house, and I beseech you to remove one Ray Dunn original from your Home Goods cart before you're even close enough for a cashier to say, "Who's next?" While I'm here offering tips, be sure to leave enough time in your shopping experience for those items near the register, which is where some of my favorite finds are. Plus, you should have extra room in your cart after giving up a find. I love the artisanal orange slices and creative s'more-type treats that you can't get anywhere else, except TJ Maxx, Marshalls, etc. Don't let anyone rush you when you're looking through those candies and cards. Relax. Settle in. Let patrons go ahead of you if they are in a rush. Savor the moments near the register, and if you've curated the items properly, you can add a few extras from the checkout area to your cart before paying and leave the heavenly store with pride. These rules also apply to the aforementioned TJ Maxx, where I'm a certified Maxinista, and Marshalls, which together with Home Goods make up the triumvirate of Midwest shopping, all of which would be flawless experiences if it weren't for the hellish way they put price stickers on their items. Why must it be so hard to get the $12.99 tag off my candle? Whose idea was it to plaster it on the middle of my glass mirror? When will our elected officials take this on? The first time I went to Miss Donna's house, I was overwhelmed by the smell of urine, but I initially didn't quite know how to place the scent. Hoarders had not been on the air at that point, so I didn't have the language to describe exactly what I saw, but this woman had definitely collected way too many knickknacks and had very clearly never left her home. Kids would stop by after school, she would teach them hand placement on the keys, and then I can only assume Miss Donna would cuddle up with Butts and Kelly to watch Dharma and Greg. When I would arrive at her house for my 4:30 p.m. lesson, Butts and Kelly would be sanctioned off in the kitchen while Miss Donna's piano was a few feet away, ready to be played. There are yappy dogs, and then there's Butts and Kelly. They were very protective of Miss Donna, so anytime anyone would arrive, they would bark like hell from the kitchen, and the woofs wouldn't stop for the entire hour. It felt loud, like Man of Steel soundtrack loud. I'd be playing Chopsticks, and Butts and Kelly would be barking along, off-key, just a few steps away from me. I don't know what exactly Miss Donna should have done about Butts and Kelly. Perhaps she could have put them in another room or found some space outside for them to hang while she taught her students. Instead, she would spend the hour yelling at them while I tried to learn the notes. She would be so kind, gentle, and sweet with me, but lost it on them. C-E-F-G... she'd say softly in that adult baby voice as I played When the Saints Go Marching In. By the time I hit the G, Butts and Kelly would begin their bark. "Butts! Kelly! Shut up!" she would shout in a deep baritone at them, going from 0 to 100 like the best Real Housewives do, only instead of a designer wrap dress, Miss Donna was wearing a t-shirt with Flicka on it. "Should I keep playing?" I'd ask. "Yes, hon, just keep going. I'm listening." C-E-F-G. Ruff! "Butts! Kelly! Shut up! I will hit you with the 2x4! Miss Donna screamed. "Is everything okay?" I queried.
Yes, of course. Just keep playing.
Hey, Butts! Hey, Kelly! Shut up! If you don't, I will get the 2x4! You know who doesn't bark? Horses don't bark!
This continued for exactly 1 hour every single lesson. Each week, pure chaos. For what it's worth, I never saw any physical abuse, and I truly don't think she had a 2x4 handy, but she did continue to threaten them. After the second lesson, I talked to my friend who also had classes with Miss Donna. Does she yell at Butts and Kelly while you're in there too? Yeah, she tells him she's going to hit him with a 2x4, my friend replied. Have you ever seen her do it? Like, does she have wood? I don't think so. Isn't it distracting? I can never get through one song because she has to keep stopping and starting, I admitted. Yeah, but my mom says she offers the cheapest lessons in town. Turns out we were getting budget lessons. We could have gone to the local music school and paid an arm and a leg to take professional classes from an expert, but we decided to drive over to Miss Donna's house once a week and get the knockoff version, complete with an out-of-tune piano and the aggressive relationship she had with her two dogs. Miss Donna never planned on using lumber. She used to live on a farm and moved to the suburbs where there was no space for horses, and she figured dogs were the next best thing. Butts and Kelly barked because they knew they would never live up to the horses Miss Donna held so dear. Every day, those cute pooches had to look around the room and see endless horse paraphernalia, knowing that they would never be the animals that Miss Donna wanted them to be. Sometimes when I'm on my Instagram, looking at my feed, which is filled with hot male models, I think about Butts and Kelly. Those dogs were constantly faced with the image of the ones they would not live up to. And Miss Donna was frustrated because the life she built for herself didn't allow her to spend time with the creatures she really loved. After less than a year of not learning anything at the lessons with Miss Donna, my mom stopped taking me. I could only play one song, When the Saints Go Marching In, on the piano, but I did learn some valuable lessons. You get what you pay for, and life is a compromise. Oh, and horses don't bark.